San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
All right, good evening, everybody. My name is Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, and producer, coming to you from KFMB Studios with 50,000 watts of power. We're heard not just in San Diego County, but Orange County, LA County, up the coast of Seattle on a good night, out to the desert, down to Cabo. And if you get the app, download the app for 760 KFMB, you can hear us stream on your smartphone. And all the podcasts are free at iwaymoney.com and 760kfmb.com. And we're free on iTunes if you search It's Your Money and Your Life. And now time to introduce the main man of the hour. He is an accomplished marathon runner. He's an accomplished author, best-selling, that is. And he is a family office advisor, advising several high-net-worth families. He's also a CPA extraordinaire. His name is Richard Muzio. Richard, good evening. How are you tonight?
I am marvelous, Joe, as always.
That is great. Hey, we've got a great show tonight, and I just want to make two quick announcements before we get going. You ever been downtown around 3rd and Ash Street during the week? There's a law office there.
Yes.
Beautiful ivy-covered building.
Right, I know it. I won't give away your secret.
Anyway, I was over there at lunch, having lunch the other day, and I've heard it before, but This office loves to play Frank Sinatra music
out loud in the streets.
Speakers blaring, right. down Ash, down 3rd there. So I said, I'm going to walk in there and thank them for doing that. And I walk in, and man, what an ornate office. It's an attorney's office. His name is King Amanpour. And they handle traffic accidents of all sorts. So perhaps if you're interested, you should just go down there for a tour. I mean, the office is really extraordinarily nice. But I went in there and thanked them, and I said I would thank him on the air for doing that. And his number is really cool. It's 619 and then all threes. 333.
Yeah, you see his billboards here and there.
Yeah, I haven't seen the billboards. Yeah. But anyway, that, and I wanted to thank Dan Audick and Scott Slater of Slater's 5050, recent guest on this show and founder and owner of the Slater's 5050 chain. And every Sunday when the Chargers are in town, they bring busloads of people down from Huntington Beach and Anaheim and all the Slater's establishments. And he invited, I said, what if I bring a Charger with a Super Bowl ring? Would you like that? And
there's no such thing as a Charger with a Super Bowl
ring.
Well,
there is.
He had to play with somebody else.
Well, there is, because Dan Audick went up with Fred Dean to the
okay, so he's a 49er with a Super Bowl ring.
Yeah, but former Charger. Let's not split hair. Don't split hairs here. Anyway, Dan brought his Super Bowl 16 ring. He was Joe Montana's left tackle for that entire season. And he passes his ring around, and boy, we ate well and drank well and got out of there. But
Super Bowl 16?
Yeah,
that was back when I could read those Roman numerals. Still.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, good for them. They beat Cincinnati Bengals in the Super Bowl in Pontiac, Michigan, January of '82. So there you have it. Hey, tonight's show, we should get right into it, Richard, because we got a really great guest. Very important guest here. I'm just going to, you've got to get into his bio a little bit. This gentleman is a writer and a public policy analyst. He's written a book called Genius in the Shadows, a biography of Leo Szilard, the man behind the bomb. He holds his bachelor's from Fordham. He's got his master's and doctor from the London School of Economics. He was a staff member, listen to this, Newsweek, National Journal in Washington, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. He's written for the Atlantic Monthly, The Economist, the Smithsonian, the Washington Post. He's quite accomplished. His biography was completed of Szilard in 91. He became a senior analyst for the U.S. Government Accountability Office, GAO, which you've all heard of. But his name is William Lanouette. And welcome to the show, Bill. Good to see you.
Thank you, Joe, and thank you, Richard.
I happened to catch your address on, believe it or not, UCSD TV, and became fascinated with the character Leo Szilard, as you were describing him. But let's get into your background a little bit. After London School of Economics, you wanted to become a political journalist of sorts, or
right? I majored in English literature at Fordham, and I had a job at Newsweek summers and weekends, and that convinced me I wanted to be a political journalist.
Huh.
And I needed some politics, so I went to the London School of Economics and did a master's in comparative government, and came back, and then I got a job in Congress, and then joined the Dow Jones Weekly, the National Observer.
So grew up in the East Coast, I take it? Or?
I grew up in Connecticut and went to college and worked in New York City.
Mm-hmm. And let's see, so...
You spent how long in Washington?
Total of 45 years.
Wow, okay.
What'd you do in Congress, by the way?
I worked for a congressman named John Monaghan from Connecticut as his legislative assistant and also on a research and technical program subcommittee that looked at, among other things, the brain drain at the time. So so I got my feet wet in some scientific activities in the government early on.
Great. And then how did you discover Leo Szilard, and what compelled you to do all your research on him?
I was doing a piece for the Atlantic Monthly in 1982, about the nuclear breeder reactor. They were going to build the fourth breeder in Oak Ridge, Tennessee at the time. And there was a time as late as the 70s when the AEC, the Atomic Energy Commission, predicted we would have 1,000 nuclear plants by the year 2000 and 100 breeders to make fuel. So this was going to be the next breeder, and there was a big fight about it. And I traced, where did the chain reaction come from, and where did the breeder reaction come from? And it turned out they both came from this guy, Leo Szilard, who I only knew as an arms control activist.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote him into the story. Then I discovered his brother, Bela, and it was irresistible that I do his biography.
Hmm. Interesting. So, well, obviously, we should... get into the book a little bit. So tell us a little bit about his early life and what you discovered.
The name of the book, by the way, is Genius in the Shadows.
Right. I mentioned that in the intro.
Right. I just want to be clear.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Szilard was born in 1898 in Budapest, Hungary, and he was self-tutored. He never went to school till, I think, eighth grade.
Huh.
And I think this explains in part why he had such a free-wheeling mind. He was a very good student, and he learned early on to think for himself. He was in the Austro-Hungarian army. There's a picture of him leaning against an artillery piece in a rather nonchalant way. He didn't take to the military life very well, and later said that his favorite hobby was baiting brass hats. But in any case, he studied engineering, and then he went off to Germany, where he decided to switch to physics. And he wanted to take a course with Max Planck, who was the father of quantum mechanics.
Yes.
And at the time, you had to call on the professor and get his permission and get him to sign a little book. And he announced to Planck, he said, I want to learn the facts of physics. I'll make up the theories myself. So he also introduced himself to Einstein and walked Einstein home from seminars and got to know him. They liked each other. They both had a similar... a sense of humor, and also discussed theology and other things. And Einstein and Szilard in the 20s designed a refrigerator with no moving parts, an electromagnetic refrigerator, and for which they took out a number of patents. Now, that refrigerator system later turned out to power the breeder reactors that Szilard thought up.
So, but they were too loud for commercial use, right? But
they made an awful lot of noise, and they would wake up any family. So they were They were no good for household use.
No moving parts, but powered by some kind of liquid metal. Is that the deal?
Exactly. It's if you can imagine a sausage being full of metal and then magnets around it, the magnets would move the metal, and that's how it that's how it circulated.
Interesting.
You think it would have been popular? There were no refrigerators around in the 1920s that even worked at all.
Well, let's keep cool because we have to take a break right now. We'll come right back with Bill Lanouette and all about Leo Szilard and the bomb right after this. Hang on.
AM 760 KFMB.
All right, we're back with... There we go. We're back with It's Your Man, Andrew Life, the award-winning show with Bill Lanouette talking about Leo Szilard and the bomb and all the great contemporaries he knew. So this gentleman actually worked on the theory to develop the nuclear chain reaction and critical mass. And I mean, did he do that himself or did he work with a little team? Because it seemed like a lot of science back then was...
Szilard loved to sit in the bathtub for hours and daydream. And... he was reading about Lord Rutherford, who ran a nuclear lab at Cambridge in England, who said that anyone who thinks you can get energy from the atom is talking moonshine. Szilard didn't know what moonshine was at the time, but he found out. And he said, an expert is somebody who tells you what can't be done. And he walked around and he thought and he thought and he thought, and about 2 weeks later he thought up the nuclear chain reaction.
But backing up a bit, why or how did he come to the U.S.?
He was then in London.
Oh, he was in London, okay.
Yeah. He fled Nazi Germany in 1933 for London, and then he moved to the U.S. He said he's going to come here a year before the war, so in 1938 he sailed for New York.
Hmm.
But he was in England, and he wasn't really connected with anybody. He filed a patent for the chain reaction. He took it to General Electric, and they said, no, it's not interesting. Took it to the Army. No, they're not interested. He eventually got the Navy to file it as a secret patent, the Admiralty, in 1936, lest the Germans find out. But he worked pretty well on his own, and he kept searching for an element that would carry out this chain reaction.
Was he concerned about being persecuted in Germany, or was...
He fled Nazi Germany right after the Reichstag fire in February of 1933.
Okay.
He knew things were getting tough. He was nominally Jewish. That was enough for the Germans, and he cleared out. He always kept two bags packed, and when it was ready, the end of March 1933, he caught a train for Vienna and then ended up in London.
Mm-hmm. But he did study in obviously Berlin and Germany for a while, I guess in the 20s, right?
He did a PhD, which became the basis for modern information theory, where he applied the concept of entropy or disorder to information and came up with the concept which is now called the bit. So it's a. But then he put that aside, and in the 1950s, Claude Shannon, who was the father of information theory at MIT, invited Szilard to a conference. And Szilard said, well, except for that one paper I did in the 20s, I really haven't thought about it. So he never came to the conference. But he loved just tossing out ideas.
Unbelievable. Yeah. What a physicist and inventor. And. Never got the Nobel Prize. We'll get into that a little bit later, I guess. So then he comes to the States in 38, and where does he land then?
He's in New York City. He runs around still looking for an element for his chain reaction. So he goes to Rochester, goes to Illinois, goes to NYU. He's trying to use their laboratories, and he just can't find out what element's going to tick off this chain reaction. So he ends up at Columbia University, where he meets Enrico Fermi, who just won the Nobel Prize in physics. And here are the two guys in the world who could create a chain reaction and end up living in the same hotel in Manhattan.
Wow. Now, were they thinking nuclear weapon at the time? Or
Szilard was. Szilard clearly thought of a nuclear weapon from 1933 on. Fermi was too cautious for Szilard's liking and said, well, maybe in 50 years it'll be useful. And, so the two of them were like oil and water, but they found out they had to stay together to work. And we had Szilard's concepts and Fermi's ingenuity, and they designed the first nuclear reactor in the summer of 1939.
And didn't they have to use a moderator to sort of facilitate their relationship?
George Pigram, the head of the physics department, kept them at arm's length at Columbia. But generally, Szilard used to just wander in and tell people what they should do and leave, and Fermi was hard at work all the time.
Fermi was a hands-on researcher, correct? He liked building things.
He was a rare fellow who could be both theoretical and practical, mm-hmm. and he built his own experimental material and his own machines, whereas Szilard was just an idea man.
A theorist. Well, no, we eventually have to start talking about Einstein. On the cover of your book is the photograph with Szilard and Einstein. And where and when was that picture taken?
There's a photograph of Einstein and Szilard sitting at a table with a pen and a document. They're recreating a letter that they drafted to Franklin Roosevelt in 1939 that warned him about German A-bomb work. Mm. And that led eventually to the Manhattan Project. Hmm. The picture on the book is a still from a documentary, The March of Time, that was actually filmed in 1946.
Mm-hmm.
But they drafted this letter, and that led eventually to Szilard and Fermi getting money at Columbia, and then eventually to the first nuclear chain reaction, which was set off at the campus of the University of Chicago in 1942.
Underneath Stagg Stadium.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So Einstein, what year did he come over here?
He came over here in 1933.
33.
And he settled in Princeton at the Institute for Advanced Study.
Gotcha. So can you verify that the story, I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, but either a reporter or somebody asked Einstein, what does it feel like to be the smartest guy in the world? And Einstein said, I don't know. You have to ask Leo Szilard. Did you hear
it? I hadn't heard that, but I know he respected Szilard an awful lot, and he trusted Szilard and obviously used Szilard's ideas. The two of them really liked each other, and they were both lateral thinkers, and they mm-hmm. would sit in kibitz for hours at a time and really enjoyed each other's company. So they respected each other. Szilard, on the other hand, at one lecture that a source mm-hmm. attended in Berlin, mm-hmm. Looked at an equation that Einstein had put on the board, and he said, you know, Professor, that's stupid. And Einstein looked at it and nodded and had to agree. So, but they respected each other intellectually, and they were good friends.
Yeah. Well, tell us about the Martians, because, you know, when he hung out with these other great minds, tell us the names and why they call them the Martians.
Well, in the Manhattan Project, there were four Hungarians, Leo Szilard, Eugene Wigner, Edward Teller, and John von Neumann. They were called the Martians because they spoke an unearthly language, Hungarian, and mm-hmm. they were superhumanly intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to joke around about how these bright guys really weren't human, but they were glad that they were on our side and not on Hitler's side.
Now, was there a real threat that Hitler did have a staff working on the same kind of project, or were we able to get him? Obviously, we got...
This is very interesting. First of all, as to a moderator, they needed what they call a moderator to slow down the neutrons. Szilard figured out that only pure graphite would work. The Germans used commercial graphite, and it didn't work.
Mm.
So they shifted to heavy water as the moderator in their reactors.
But isn't heavy water almost impossible to get?
Well, it was impossible to get during the war, and especially when the Allies destroyed mm-hmm. the chief source in Norway.
Right.
So there's an interesting crossing point in June of 1942. At that point, Werner Heisenberg went to Albert Speer, who was head of munitions and armaments in the Nazi regime,
mm-hmm.
and said, we don't think that this atomic energy is going to work in time before we win the war. And so there's really no point in continuing. That was the same month we gave the work to the Army in what became the Manhattan Project. So the month that they scaled down and effectively got out of the business, the U.S. Went full speed ahead.
Wow. Well, we'll get into more of this fascinating history with Bill Lanouette right after news, sports, and weather. Hang on. MB. All right. We are back with the award-winning It's Your Money and Your Life. Over to Richard to thank our sponsors.
Big thanks to all of our sponsors. Without all of our sponsors, we couldn't win all of the first-place awards we win at the San Diego Press Club like we're going to do. Well, on Tuesday night.
Well, we'll get something.
We're going to get something. We know. Yeah, they told us show up because you're getting something. So it'll be more than just a handshake and a pat on the back. UBS, Michael Carrancha and Drew Freitas, thank you very much. Right across the street in downtown La Jolla, right across Prospect Street, the best business bank in San Diego, that would be Regents Bank with Sean Puckett and Steve Sefton. Jason Kruger with Signature Analytics, helping companies that need CFOs to understand their financial matters a little bit better. Our favorite CPAs on the planet who just survived the October 15th deadline, Don Epic CPA and Paul Polito CPA with Pluto Epic CPAs up in Vista. Brenda Geiger and the law office of Brenda Geiger, Asset Protection and Estate Planning. She's got a new book coming out. She's a prolific author. Our favorite real estate guy on the planet, Joel Grushkin, Cost Segregation Initiatives, helping real estate owners improve their cash flow. And last but not least, a very recent guest, Mr. Carl Sheeler with Berkeley Research Group, best business valuation firm on planet Earth, helping business owners understand the risks that drive their businesses and ways to reduce those risks so that the values of the business can increase. Also, big thank you to PopX Graphics and Courtney Lauber. I guess one of the awards we're up for this year is for having the best radio show website on the Western Hemisphere, or in the Western Hemisphere. We couldn't do it without Courtney, so thank you to her.
So we'll get results on Tuesday, and
we're going to know.
Yeah.
So next show, I guess we'll
mm-hmm.
let people know.
Mm-hmm.
Will they be really happy or really sad? Joe, how can people find out more about our amazing group of sponsors?
Well, all they have to do is get over to iymoney.com, get your cursor over to the sponsors tab along the top of the page there. There's a drop-down menu. Click on any one or all of them, and all of their biographical information, contact info is there. And they've all been working with Richard for many, many years with great success. Correct, Richard?
In some cases, back to the late 80s.
Yes, our last guest, Carl Schuler, said he's actually developed some clients from listeners to this
many,
show.
Many of our sponsors have developed clients because people listen to our show. And, you know, we set the bar really high last year, Joe, with those three First Place Press Club awards. So I've got my fingers crossed.
I hope we get at least one or two
exactly.
blue ribbons, but... I'm confident. We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see.
Hey, it's just fun to get there. There's about 600 people
in
the press club, members and guests. It's a lot of fun. Anyway, back to our esteemed guest, Bill Lanouette, who's an accomplished writer, author, and his book, of course, is Genius in the Shadows, about Leo Szilard, who did have a San Diego and La Jolla connection. We'll get into it toward the end of his life there, but where did we leave off? We left off with the Nazis, and we were scaling up while they were scaling down, and, of course, the rest is history. Now, when we finally dropped, and of course, the letter to FDR must have worked, obviously.
It did.
Then tell the story about...
But Einstein was the facilitator of that piece of correspondence, correct? Because he knew, I forget who he knew, it's in your book.
It's a strange relationship because at the time, in 1939, both Szilard and Einstein consider themselves to be pacifists.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they were investigated by the government, correct?
They were very reluctant, in fact, to suggest this, but they saw this as a defensive necessity against the possibility of a German A-bomb.
Mm-hmm.
By the spring of 1945, the Germans were clearly defeated, And Szilard had Einstein send another letter to FDR saying you should talk to Dr. Szilard about post-war consequences of his work. Now, so Einstein was not involved in the bomb work at all, and after the war said that his only role was as Leo Szilard's mailbox. Mm-hmm. So,
and then, of course, FDR passes away in April of 45. He didn't even live long enough to see the end of World War II, unfortunately. So then Truman came in.
And then Szilard took that letter to Truman, and he was sent down to Spartanburg, South Carolina, to meet a guy named Jimmy Burns. And he took along Harold Urey, who also had a distinguished career here at UC San Diego.
Absolutely.
And the two of them went down. Two Manhattan Project scientists who wanted to stop the bomb talked to the man who couldn't wait to use it. Burns thought that the bomb was necessary to intimidate the Russians, and that if you didn't use it, how would you justify the $2 billion you spent behind Congress's back? So I've actually written a play called Uranium Plus Peaches about that meeting in Spartanburg where the scientists confront the politician over the bomb.
And then, of course, the Cuban Missile Crisis in October of 61, wasn't
62,
it?
62, yeah. I think.
And that was right toward the end of Szilard's life, but he must have been very troubled what was going on right there.
He was scared to death. He thought, finally, we're going to have a nuclear war, which he had tried to prevent even before the end of World War II. He had worked with the Pugwash conferences to get scientists together to talk about this. He had worked to found what was called the Council for a Livable World, a political action committee. He was striving all for the rest of his life to try to control the bomb.
But he
was so scared when Kennedy went on TV to announce the blockade that he packed his bags and went to Geneva.
But didn't the government stamp a lot of his work as secret for about 15 years or so after the war?
Oh, indeed. And in fact, one of the things he tried just before the end of the war was a petition. 155 Manhattan Project scientists signed a petition calling for a demonstration of the bomb before you use it on cities.
Mm.
And after the war, he wanted to try to publish that petition, and General Groves, the head of the Manhattan Project, had it stamped secret, and it wasn't declassified till 1963, the year before Szilard died.
Hmm. Well, my mother always had the theory that with regard to, you know, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, why didn't we drop the bomb just off the coast, or maybe just outside the city, so they could see the devastation rather than kill 240,000 people with those two bomb droppings. Did that ever occur to anybody?
Well, the scientists were asked that question at one of the meetings of what they called the Interim Committee, which was deciding on the use of the bomb. And the scientists themselves said, well, we're not sure that a second bomb is going to work. They knew the first bomb would work and never tested it. It was made with uranium, but the plutonium bombs, they didn't know would work until 2 weeks before they used one on Hiroshima. And so they thought, if we set up a demonstration and it doesn't work, then where are we? And they argued against people like Oppenheimer, argued against trying to have a demonstration. But there was in the poll, 83% of the scientists thought a demonstration before use against cities was important to do.
Yeah. There's a little known story, I guess, when John Wayne, one of his last films, they were filming out in, I don't know if it's the Utah or Nevada desert, near where they tested a lot of these bombs, and we did test quite a few. How many bombs did we test, do you think, over the years?
900.
Is that amazing?
That's a few, Joe.
Amazing?
About a third of them above ground.
Okay.
In the United States.
Yeah.
Isn't that something?
Szilard had an interesting take on this. There was a big debate in 1962, wow. I think, about a test ban treaty, where we would not only not have tests in the atmosphere, but not have them at all. And they said, well, we shouldn't test. And Szilard being ever contrary, said to one of the scientists on a talk show, he said, "Oh, no, we should test them, everyone."
Well, the point being, now, I think it was William Powell and John Wayne and a whole bunch of the cast and crew came down with cancer because they, I guess they were downwind from where they were testing a lot of these nuclear bombs. And that's in, you know, that's, I forget the name of the film, but if you look it up and Google it, I'm sure you could find it. But it's a sad fact there.
Well, cancer was a result of a lot of downwinders, as they were called, in St. George, Utah. Is famous for the number of people who contracted cancer. That was right down from the downwind from the Nevada test site. Whether they could have been exposed just on one movie shoot is unlikely, but it's something that in the long run, people who are exposed to radioactive fallout have developed abnormally high rates of cancer.
Well, I think that figure of 900 nuclear bombs tested, we should get that article out there at a Huffington Post or something. But in any case, we've got to take a little break right here, Bill. But stick around, everybody. We'll come right back with more about the bomb and Bill Lanois.
AM 760 KFMB.
All right, we are back in the home stretch with Bill Lanois talking about Leo Szilard, the genius in the shadows. He's the man behind the bomb. A lot of people hadn't heard of this guy, but believe it or not, there is a San Diego and La Jolla and UCSD connection. And who knows, maybe his presence coming here and attracting a lot of scientists may have helped spur the birth of UCSD. Maybe you have a theory about that, but tell us about how when he first came here and the end of his life.
Leo Szilard, after World War II, switched from physics to biology, which is a subject he wanted to take up for years, and finally got a chance to do that.
This guy's a modern-day Da Vinci, wouldn't you say?
He really was. He thought up a great number of things. Mm-hmm. In 1957 and again in 1958, somebody at the General Atomics invited him out to do some consulting on new ideas of nuclear reactors. And it was the first nuclear work that Szilard had ever taken up, and he came out here for two summers and had a marvelous time sitting by the pool and working on a yellow pad.
And the pool was where?
I'm not sure.
He first stayed at La Valencia.
La Valencia.
Right?
It may have been the Del Charro. I'm not sure. I know he lived there later, but when he was here, he fell in love with La Jolla.
Mm-hmm.
And in January of 57, he met Jonas Salk at a conference in New York City and proposed to him something that Szilard had been working on a long time, which is a new science center that combines hard science with the social implications of hard science. And they tried to enlist Salk, and he wasn't too interested.
He wanted to stay in Pittsburgh, right?
Right. And Szilard said, "Well, no first-rate scientists will move to Pittsburgh, Jonas. You have to put it somewhere else." And working with Roger Revelle and some people at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography and with the lure of the science at General Atomics and the new UCSD campus, he eventually persuaded Salk to take seriously the idea of setting up a new institute here. Salk had considered Stanford University for a while, but they didn't really come up with anything. So in a real way, Szilard not only gave Salk the idea for the kind of institute that he set up, but he also gave him the place to set it up.
So that institute does combine public policy and science and all that?
It started to do that. Mm-hmm. They had these two pillars. One is hard science. Mm-hmm. One is the social consequences. Mm-hmm. And Szilard was responsible for that. But Szilard only lived here a few months, and the task fell then to Jacob Bronowski, who became involved with his own television show on the ascent of man and other things. And according to Salk, he said that aspect of the center really fell by the wayside.
Now, Leo never owned a home. He lived out of suitcases.
Is it true he didn't drive?
He didn't drive, never drove.
Hey, my youngest daughter, who's 18, doesn't drive.
Maybe she's going to invent something. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. But tell us about the Hotel Del Charro and the end of his life, because that was a fascinating place owned by these wealthy oil guys out of Texas, right?
Murchison
and Sid Richardson.
Who actually wound up owning the Del Mar racetrack for a while.
Yeah, richest guys in the world.
They were setting up the Salk Institute at the top of the Mesa, and down to the bottom of the Mesa, where the La Jolla Parkway now meets Torrey Pines Road, there was an old stable that had been turned into a hotel, and the stables became bungalows, and then they also added another wing, and it was called the Del Charro Hotel.
Del Charro. Mm-hmm.
So it was really the closest motel or hotel to where the Salk Institute was. Szilard first moved into the La Valencia, and his wife loved it, but he said he didn't like the La Valencia because by moving in, he lowered the average age by 10 years.
You mean of La Jolla residents. Yeah,
so they found this wonderful little bungalow right off Torrey Pines Road.
Now, mind you, by today's standards, those rooms would be like $800 a day or something, because it was a ritzy place by today's standards.
It was, but for some reason they got a cut rate. I guess they liked them. Other scientists like Edward Teller would stay there.
But Edgar Hoover would come in to play the horses.
Yes, every year for like
years.
10 years. Yeah.
And
of course, everything paid for him, I'm sure.
He was the guest of Murchison, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a map of the hotel that shows that Leo Szilard's cottage was right across the road from Mr. Hoover's cottage. Whether the two ever met, I'm not sure. But it was a big hangout for people playing the horses, and Hollywood stars would come down.
It was like Hollywood meets Washington meets academia. I mean, it's all the biggest celebs of all walks of life, correct?
One of the strangest places for a guy like Szilard to end up.
And major crime figures, for gosh sake. So it was amazing. There's a story I think Matt Potter told in The Reader where they were all lounging around the pool, and I forget if it was Sid Richardson or somebody they yelled over to J. Edgar Hoover, "Hey, Edgar, get off your blank and go bring me a bowl of chili." And he did. That's how much influence and power these guys had. So.
I've heard another story related to that. A photographer was hired by the Del Charro to photograph the guests as they were sitting around the pool at cocktail hour. And one guy said, "Put that away." And he said, "But the hotel hired me. Put that away." No pictures. It was Hoover.
Well, you know, who would recognize him in men's clothes anyway? But I'm bump. Now, Leo Szilard had 10 commandments. I see that we should discuss at least a couple of them. I love this one. Do not destroy what you cannot create. In reference to the bomb, that's pretty profound.
Is that supposed to be like thou shalt not kill?
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, number 6 is do not covet what you cannot have. And instead of, you know, always told you, he said, do not lie without need, which is, gives you a little out.
It's relative,
gives you a little escape clause there.
Exactly.
And here's an interesting one. Says,
Bill Clinton liked that one,
yeah. Here's one says, honor children, listen reverently to their words, and speak to them with infinite love. That's pretty profound. Number 10, the last one here, lead your life with a gentle hand and be ready to leave whenever you are called. As if we have a choice, right?
Well, Szilard really turned the honor thy father and thy mother around by saying you should honor children instead.
Mm-hmm.
And one of his last wishes when he was asked about what would happen to his ashes, he said, "Oh, I think you should just put them in brightly colored balloons and release them, because then at least it will delight all the children."
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
So, Bill, do you have a website for the book?
I do not. The publisher has a website.
Okay.
And it's
how can people find it?
It's the Skyhorse Publishing, and
if you just Google,
here we go. www.skyhorsepublishing.com.
SkyhorsePublishing.com.
And I'm sure it's sold at a few other places on Amazon and whatnot. But Genius in the Shadows, or Bill Lanouet, Lanouette, of course. But, gosh, it's just been a fascinating hour with you, Bill. We'll have to have you back again and talk some more about this stuff in the Hotel Del Charro, which was a notorious place. It's too bad it's not still around. I wonder why it's gone, but... I'll bet all those great celebrity of that place and all the great minds that were attracted here due to the beauty of La Jolla probably helped spur that institution on, don't you think, UCSD?
It's nicer than Pittsburgh. Indeed. I've been to both places. Yeah.
We'll have to talk about Bill Lirak about this, too. So anyway, thanks so much for being our guest.
Thank you.
And Richard, always great to see you. We'll see how we do at the press club. Justin Hart on the soundboard, thanks for making us sound great. And thank you to Craig Blanke, our account executive, and to Dave Sniff, our programming genius here at KFMB. Go Chargers. Have a great week, everybody. And we'll see you next time. And all the podcasts are at iymoney.com. Good night now. But right after this, hang on.